I'm sure that for many of us, we're grateful that those Christmas earworms are receding. Don't fear, I'm not going to mention any titles and certainly not going to hum any tunes for you. But there is one line from one 60s pop song that I find I have in my head an awful lot. I can never lose it. Disappointment haunted all their dreams. There'll be a free cup of coffee for anybody who can come and tell me afterwards who sang it. And I look forward to hearing. But it's that lurking fear that all will not end well, that hopes will be dashed, maybe again. And maybe you've experienced that, maybe you are experienced that, maybe it happened over Christmas where once again you thought getting the family together for a week was a great idea and was all going to work. Maybe you hoped your football team would be heading for Champions League, but it's struggling, battling relegation. Maybe you'd hoped that the new year would see a change in you as a character, but actually you've discovered you're the same old person that you were before. And those disappointments often make it much harder for us to commit wholeheartedly, because we've got that feeling that, well, if I invest a bit less, then maybe the letdown, maybe the hurt will also be less. And this thought of disappointment lies, as we heard in the video, in the background, sometimes the foreground, of this book of Ezra. There's no happy ending. The rebuild turns out to be a bit of a damp squib. The disobedience of the people is shameful, as we'll discover over the next few weeks. And is always the case, when hopes were high as they were, the disappointment is all the greater. Hadn't God said that there would be a glorious return to the land and to Jerusalem? Hadn't God promised a magnificent place to which all the nations of the earth would come? But they are few. The progress is slow. The opposition is strong. And the city and the temple seem so small. Let alone the fact of their heart response, which is often shameful. Disappointment haunted all their dreams. And Ezra writes these, in our case, two books, in order to address that disappointment. He wants them to lift their eyes and to lift the eyes of succeeding generations of believers like us, to lift our eyes from our immediate circumstances, to look back to what God has done in the past and to be confident about him delivering his promises for the future. Now, you may be wondering, why on earth are we looking at this from so many centuries ago? What's this got to do with us? And one of the things that we need to remember as we read the Old Testament, where we read there about Jerusalem, where we read there about the temple, we need to understand that as the church. Israel is God's people. We are God's people. Yes, we are those whom Jesus has brought and gathered into this company. We are the church that he is building in these days. And the lessons from the past can be hugely helpful to us as we seek to serve him and work for him in these days. But of course, disappointments are everywhere. The church is very good at disappointing. Jesus said he came for sinners. He gave a welcome to everybody. But maybe your experience in the past has not been that of welcome. In which case, thank you for trying again. Thank you very much for being here this morning and giving it another go. Jesus tells us that the good news about him is good seed, seed that will grow. But we and many churches like us in this country are finding that growth very, very slow. Fewer and fewer people coming on courses like Christianity Explored. It seems very hard at the moment. Jesus promises to build his church, but we find that discipleship is painstaking. Step by step, three steps forward, two steps back, or the other way around. Maintaining unity is hard. New initiatives fail. Jesus promises us change in ourselves as individuals by the work of his Spirit. But we know, as we look at ourselves, that all too often we seem to be going backwards and not forwards. We are continually disappointed by our progress in the faith. Do we trust Jesus more this January than we did last January? Would we say that we're more Christ-like this January as opposed to five Januaries ago? Yes, we have high hopes. We have high hopes because our God is great and because his promises are great. And that's what Ezra turns us to. He wants to lift the disappointed. He wants to enable them to get back to work, to serve their God, to build his people, to build the church. And hopefully, as we engage with Ezra over these next few weeks, we may discover what Christopher Ashe says very helpfully. To belong in a committed and relational way to an ordinary local church may be the most significant thing you do with your life. Ponder that. Consider that. Because it's the job of the church to bring Jesus to the world today. We're a vital vehicle in God's plan for the rescue of his world. The church really matters. So let's see how Ezra addresses the disappointments of his day and seeks to encourage us and every church age. The first great thing we see is that the Lord moves the king. It's there in verse 1. The Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia. And that gives us the encouragement, as we've prayed, that the sovereign God is at work in the lives of the rulers of our world. He had brought Cyrus to power. He was a sort of a local warlord, but suddenly, apparently, his people, the Persians, destroy the world power, the Babylonians. They take Babylon almost without a shot being fired. That's 539 BC. And as you know, empires were run in different ways by different leaders. Cyrus's plan for Persia was that they would rule their empire by giving a degree of autonomy to the local areas. So people whom the previous Babylonian rulers had captured were sent back. Plunder that had been taken by the Babylonians was returned, such that there could be peace, stability, rebuilding within those outlying nations and territories. It's a good policy, keeps people happy, makes control easier, and undoubtedly brings in good tax revenues. But the way in which the Bible sees that is to say God stirred him up. God calls him in the book of Isaiah, my shepherd. He addressed him as the Lord's anointed. He has chosen Cyrus. He stirred Cyrus to be kind to God's people. And he does it in fulfillment of his words. Jeremiah 25, as we heard, then after 70 years are completed, I will punish the king of Babylon. Their time was over, according to God's word. That word rules. A few chapters later, Jeremiah 29, verse 10, when 70 years are completed for Babylon, I will visit you and I will fulfill my promise to you and bring you back to this place. And Cyrus gives us that sense in verse 2, doesn't he? The Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth. He's charged me to build him a house at Jerusalem, which is in Judah. And his actions match his words. Verses 7 to 11, he offers them support. He sends people and he sends money. Look at all the gold and silver in verse 9. 410 bowls of silver, 1,000 other vessels, the total number, verse 11, 5,400. He puts his money where his mouth is, we'd say. This is no empty election promise, is it? Because the Lord moved the heart of Cyrus. His will is irresistible, whoever you are. And it's important we remember that as we look at our world, isn't it? What do you look when you see? Are you fearful of the growth and spread of Islam and its persecution of Christian communities? Are you fearful of the anti-democratic strongman leaders that we have around the world at the moment? How do we see Jesus growing his church under those leaderships and those pressures? Maybe more threatening is the fact that the two-thirds world generally aspires to be like the first world, where consumerism, secularism, and individualism are in charge. As somebody wrote in the Financial Times not that long ago, the soul of the nation does not reside in Speaker's Corner, but in IKEA car parks, and middling gastropubs on weekend afternoons. That's the soul of the nation. That's what we aspire to. That's the comfort and ease that we look for. Life is about nice furnishings and nice food. But as we look at that world, we don't despair. As we look at that world, we remember that Jesus' plan for this period of history is that his good news goes out to that world and brings people to trust in him. And we see that happening apace in various parts of the world, South America, parts of Africa, and Southeast Asia. And so we go on and pray that he will move within the governments and the powerful within our world such that that work may thrive, so that we may see more gospel growth in our own day. And of course, we'd love it to happen now, wouldn't we? We'd love to see revival in our own country next week. Wouldn't that be fantastic? But we have to trust the timings to him. Don Carson put it like this. God took 12 years to bring down Hitler, 70 to bring down the Russian Empire, 2 centuries to humble the British Empire. He is at work in his own time to bring about his plans and purposes. And the past encourages us to leave behind our disappointments in the present state of play, because he moves in the rulers of our world to bend them to his will and purpose. The Lord moves the rulers. Secondly, the Lord moves the people. The sovereign God is at work in his people. Now, I wonder what you think is the harder of the two things. Is it harder to move Cyrus to make his decree? Or is it harder to move the people from Babylon back to Palestine? The map gives you a bit of an idea of where they are. That's Babylon and that's Palestine. It's about 1,000 kilometres from the one to the other. And as we just got a glimpse of in the video, many would have only known life in Babylonia. They wouldn't have known what it was like to live in Jerusalem in Palestine. All they knew was that it was a ruined land and a ruined city. So, you know, we might hear their excuses, mightn't we? They say, look, we're settled, we're comfortable, life works here, why on earth should we move? We've got homes, we've got jobs, we're settled. We've got the children's names down for that good school, it's going to be absolutely fine here. That's where we want them to go, isn't it? Yeah, but I've heard that Rebecca's in-laws are staying and Nahum, he's sticking around and his family. Why would we want to leave them behind? After all, Palestine, Jerusalem, that's never been our home. We hear some of the natives there might be a bit hostile, not very friendly. It's a long way away. We've never been there. Let's stay. Well, some did say exactly those things. But God moved others. Look at verse 5. Then he rose up the heads of the fathers' houses of Judah and Benjamin and the priests and the Levites, everyone whose spirit God had stirred to go up to rebuild the house of the Lord that is in Jerusalem. And we get that dramatic list in chapter 2, verse 64. The whole assembly was 42,360, plus slaves, and they were dispersed around the land, verse 70. So God did move the people. God did bring them to the place where he wanted them. He did get them to go. But he also got them to give. Look at verse 69. According to their ability, they gave to the treasury of the work 61,000 darics of gold, 5,000 minas of silver, and 100 priests' garments. They give generously. And interestingly, those who stay behind give generously as well. Go back to verse 6 of chapter 1. All who were about them, that is not those who are leaving, aided them, those who are going, with vessels of silver, gold, goods, beasts, costly wares, besides all that was freely offered. We wonder whether there might be some elements of guilt there, don't we? We're not going to go, but we'll help you to go, that sort of thinking. But the truth is, unless the Lord moves the heart of his people to go or to give, then nothing can change. And what a delight and a joy it is within a church family when we experience the Lord Jesus doing just that, moving us in order to help us to continue his work of building the church. Sometimes he calls us to go to different places. Sometimes he calls us to go abroad in order to do that, doesn't he? Maybe you're wrestling with that sort of call and move on your life at the moment. It was really encouraging on Wednesday at prayer meeting to see some people who had not been to prayer meeting before. We won't call them New Year's resolutions because that's a bit old hat, isn't it? But just great to see people at the start of a new year taking that opportunity, that step to come along and to be there and be part of that. Great this morning to see folks stepping up and taking on responsibilities in the ark because Anne Keenan's had to step back for a few weeks following her father's death. That's how church family works. We step up, we feel God move us, and we get involved more. And that gives us great confidence as we look towards the women's breakfast and the jazz evening, that we will have friends in mind to be praying for, and we will have those who don't yet trust in Jesus there. It gives the PCC confidence as we meet tomorrow night in order to look at the budget for this year and how we're going to meet our financial responsibilities. God's people are generous in supporting the work of building the church, as we've seen here. And the great good news is we all play our part, seen or unseen. We all play our part, more or less active. We all play our part, whether the gift we've got to give is time or whether it's money. And yet, we can feel the temptation sometimes to say, you know, what on earth can I do? The world's too big. It's too complex. What can I do? Everyone's better equipped than I am. What can I do? I messed up last time. What can I do? They let me down before. Well, with the encouragement from these believers from all this time ago, we can pray and we can give. We can invite friends to the women's breakfast and to the jazz evening. We can find an escape from our past failures by trusting God anew for the present. By reminding ourselves that it's not all about me, it's about us. We are in this together. We're part of a bigger whole. And together, we're part of God's plan for these days, as the name of Jesus goes out all over the world, including here in Tunbridge Wells, that his church may be built. Encouragement for the fact that we are the inheritors of God's promises and that he's always faithful to his words. Now, I fully understand that some of us are more naturally optimistic. Some of us are more naturally pessimistic. But the danger is we tend to just live in our negativity or our positivity, which of course is to deny the fact that God by his Spirit can change us. But it's a mistake Ezra would point to us and say, look, you're looking for the answer within. There's no answer within. You've got to look for your answer outside. Lift your eyes to the God who has done great things in the past. Lift your eyes to the God who has made great promises for the future. Be encouraged out of your disappointment. Don't let that rule you. Let your great and all-powerful sovereign Lord rule you. Let his word and his promise for the future bring you the encouragement that you need. As we look to a God who moves his people, who shapes his people, that we may go and serve where we are as the people that he's made and gifted us to be. That we may support his work of building the church in these days. The Lord moves his people. So how do you feel about life? How do you feel about church life at the start of this new year? Ezra's purpose is to encourage the disappointed, to remember all that God has done in the past, to remember his power and to remember his promises. Maybe this year you'll discover the truth of Christopher Ashe's words. To belong in a committed and relational way to an ordinary local church may be the most significant thing you do with your life. And maybe this year you'll no longer say that disappointment haunted all your dreams, but rather you'll say, I'm a believer.